There was a recent Full Speed Ahead podcast. I think it was episode 3, where you mentioned that a lot of disability services work is like oral history. So there are kind of ways that we go about doing things, little wording and phrases, language that we use for decisions that kind of gets passed down from or passed across from institution to institution. And I think that as professionals, sometimes we become so used to that language and the frameworks that it's important to remember that those are often brand new for students. And especially if you are new to a disability identity, you are new to a political understanding of disability, if you've never seen yourself as disabled, as many of the disabled students of color I work with, like that's not a political identity that they hold. I think a lot of the, whether it's legalese or just like institutional speak and the rhetoric that we have around accommodation, isn't accessible. And so that ability to offer another way into conversations around access to sit with somebody individually, I think they're just assumptions that we make around the adequacy of our language and that it will be clear and intelligible and that students should be able to understand it and that you should go on the website if you have questions and that should all make sense to you and you should know what to do by the time you walk into the office. And that's just not, in my experience, that's not how students experience that. I think when you sit with them and you're talking to them and you ask them what their next steps are, or you hear from them like how they're making sense of what they need to do, you can see where some of that isn't, it's not, and it doesn't make sense to folks. Like it's not intuitively how they think about their experience. Like it's a very specific kind of frame. And so just learning through conversation with students around how to just be human in conversation and be collaborative rather than kind of gatekeeping a process that has historically kept disabled students of color out of disability services spaces.
That's so well put. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. As you all point out in your introductory note, a race-evasive orientation to disability impedes identity development for disabled students of color. Stakes are really high for students themselves, of course, for all of you. The stakes were very high. And for colleges to retain you and those students. Can you define racial cognizance and talk more about what we should be doing?
I think at a minimum, racial cognizance looks like an ongoing process of reflecting and becoming aware of the way that disability identity is inherently racialized, and not just when we're talking about disabled students of color, but the ways in which higher ed institutions have kind of organized themselves around disability access and individualized disability access and histories of accessibility standards. Like whiteness and white students have kind of been at the center of that in so many ways, either by being in the groups of students who were participating in the studies that defined our physical standards, or just that they have the ways that we've created documentation standards and individualized processes have created opportunity for students who can access those who disproportionately historically have been white, middle class, not first generation students. And so I think as professionals, sometimes we can see, because we work in an area that is really informed by the law, by civil rights law around disability, that we can think of that as neutral in some way, like not neutral in terms of political political disability identity, but neutral around other identity categories. And so I think really pushing ourselves to say, who are we observing this working for? Who maybe has come into the office and never comes back again? Do we, when we're doing our analyses of our, you know, our reporting at the end of the semester, our numbers, our student population, do we include race, ethnicity at a minimum in kind of understanding how are we serving the campus population? Are our numbers reflective of the broader diversity on the campus? If not, what might that lead us to think about? So I think that there's just an awareness that comes with thinking about like who is in front of me, how well are they being served by these structures, what are their experiences, how can I learn more. I think the special issue is a great entry point for a lot of practitioners into greater awareness of those experiences on their campus. I think that that ability to like not just be looked at, but be seen, like how do you really see the experiences of disabled students of color on campus, involves not assuming that because you've written a process out on the website and it's the same for everyone, that that is not going to land differently for students who are students of color. There's a narrative that I've heard everywhere I've worked in disability services that students had IEPs in high school. All right, so we're already like narrowing the population in one way. But students coming from high school have IEPs, and then they choose not to request accommodations in college until they have, they're struggling, and then they realize that they actually need them, and then they come to us. That's like a little bit reductive around what students are navigating and experiencing as they're making decisions about access, disclosure, even just like awareness. Some of the language changes from high school to college so much that sometimes students aren't recognizing that accessibility services means what they're used to thinking about as special education. Mm-hmm. So we had all these ways of talking about why students might not disclose that were really narrow, like the way that they're building an understanding of disabled students' experiences is that no one is going to, like, if someone hasn't requested accommodations, it's not because they don't see themselves as disabled, because they've been socialized not to, and because there aren't, when you think about like our public imagination, like there aren't a lot of disabled folks of color who you see represented. It's not because they're, you know, experiencing barriers to accessing a diagnosis, whether or not those are structural related to health insurance or medical racism. Like, it just was, it was so like, no, it's an individual's fault that they haven't come to our office.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. That was really eloquent. And I use all those bad examples. I'm sorry to say.
They're very sort of
stock,
yeah,
ways of thinking about the problem in the field. So I really appreciate this conversation. And I just need like 5 more hours of mentoring, Julia. To change those habits of mind, you know?
It's the oral history part of disability services. We heard it someplace, and then we say it, and then the next person says it, and we don't pause the racial cognizance piece. We don't pause to think about where did those come from? What is the impact that they have? Whose experience does that speak to? And whose experience does that drastically overlook in a way that can be really dismissive? So,
yeah. So if listeners haven't yet, the next thing that they should all read is the special issue. What should people be reading to open up their hearts and minds about these issues on college campuses?
So I mentioned earlier that I would speak a bit about my research with Black disabled faculty members. To contextualize, right, my disclosure in 2020, I disclosed during the George Floyd protests. Some of that discussion was around people with mental health disabilities or mental illnesses and their experiences with police brutality. Unfortunately, I had one of those experiences, and I chose to write about it in an op-ed, which was published in Diverse Issues in Higher Education. Tough decision to come to. And, you know, after I made the decision, I was like, okay, what can I find about people who have disclosed who went on to become faculty members? And I couldn't find anything about faculty members of color who are disability, the research who are faculty members of color who are disabled. And there was some research on disabled faculty, and that's, you know, continuing to be a growing field. But I saw that this was a big research gap in terms of actually looking at intersections of race and disability for faculty members. So it was aspirational to do this qualitative research project seeking those participants' experiences. I ended up recruiting 26 Black disabled faculty members. The first manuscript to come out of it, out of the study, was published in the Review of Higher Education, and it's called Minimizing Marginalization, Black Disabled Faculty Nondisclosure. So all participants who haven't disclosed, but I found that they exist. And so that study shares their experiences, shares some of the reasons why they don't disclose, and I have some more work coming out from the project. The other work that I want to pitch right now is of Gabrielle. Gabrielle is working on his dissertation, and like Kat, Gabrielle incorporates art into his research, and he has an Instagram page that is documenting his dissertation work as he's doing it. It's called Joteria Crips Art Collective. So that's very low labor to go on Instagram and follow that page and see, you know, these beautiful posts come up. Gabrielle, you know, he's getting to the finish line now and excited to see the stuff published. But the fact that he's engaging and communicating his work in this way shows how he's reaching beyond the academy. And he's, you know, really trying to make a broader impact and is just doing it in very creative and beautiful ways.
This is Julia. I would share really anything that comes out of the Critical Design Lab at Vanderbilt University. So that's that is led by Dr. Amy Hamrahi. They take an anti-racist approach to critical design work. So a lot of their work focuses more on architecture, but is also very much about access protocols, built environments, collective access. So they have a podcast series called Contras, and those podcasts are phenomenal. They both have like incredible guests, but also the ideas that they explore, I think, are really, really interesting and often kind of do a really effective job at thinking through and applying disability justice principles and carrying that anti-racist focus into thinking about design of the built environment and how political the built environment is. And so I would say the Critical Design Lab, everything that they have made, and specifically the Contra podcast as a part of that body of work.
If I can add, this is Kat again, I would say there's some really really exciting projects coming out of the HAT Labs, Humanities and Technologies Lab out of Northwestern University. Recently, I was one of the four scholars brought there for a weekend to do a lot of work on Blackness and disability. So that stuff should be dropping maybe in the summer. And so that's really exciting, bringing people from outside of education and all coming together to do really fascinating work together. Similarly, I would say I have a piece coming out very soon that is another long form poem, my second long form creative scholarly piece called Now That I'm Here, An Assertion. And it's really ethnopoetics on what do we do now? I'm tenure track. I'm outwardly disabled and I do things differently. And what are we going to do about it? And so really exciting things coming out. And of course, the research projects that I mentioned really allow me to go a little bit deeper beyond a U.S. context and thinking about college personnel outside of the U.S. in Anglophone Caribbean context. And what does that look like when disability is looked at very differently in different country contexts and geographics all. So I'm a little bit in like three different places, but they're all really meaningful to me.
Great. Great. This Gabrielle, what should I read next?
Yeah, this is Gabrielle. And first, I want to thank Daniel for making a shout out to the Joteria Crips Art Collective Instagram. I hope you all do go and follow that account. And echoing what I yearn for of us engaging with those creating knowledge outside of the academy is pick up local zines. Zines are a major part of my own work and my dissertation work. So if you see a local zine in your community, zines are one of the ways that a lot of people self-publish their own work about living with disabilities, about queer and trans experiences. So I would say go pick up local zines, support a local zine maker, and engage in the work that is happening outside of the academy. Follow a disability scholar that is not in the academy and engage with those outside of the academy, also talking about the experiences of people of color who live with disabilities.
Yeah, thank you. Daniel?
I just wanted to make sure Gabrielle articulates the dissertation because I just mentioned the Instagram, but, you know, exploring Latinx identities and disability through art and the collectives that you're organizing, I think it would be powerful to share your process.
My current dissertation study is tentatively titled Joteria Crips in the Academy, the experiences of queer and trans Latinx people with disabilities at Texas Hispanic serving institutions, utilizing arts-based participatory methods. And what I've really been engaging with is how do we create an art collective that engages both the community and the university to explore the experiences of students, both undergraduate and graduate students who live with disabilities, specifically at the intersection of being queer or trans, being Latinx, and living with a disability, especially as we navigate the current political climate that is hostile to all of these identities in Texas. So it's really important how the current political climate and context of Texas is shaping the way that we survive and thrive in these specific Texas Hispanic serving institutions. And the way that using art is so integral to exploring these experiences, using photography, visual art, poetry, essays, which includes my own art as well, to speak about these experiences. And I think it really is about how do we engage the community and how do we engage people outside of the academy with what's happening to the university and engage our work and create work that also is engaging the community. So a part of My dissertation work is creating a zine that is accessible to anybody in the community. And also I'll be having an art exhibition here in Austin on June 14th. We will be hosting the Birthing Joteria Crips exhibition, which will be local artists that are showcasing some of their work, thinking about their own identities. So this work is really about how do we talk about our experiences that are happening in colleges and universities and then showcase that also to the community.
That sounds so fabulous. Just, I do want to end with asking, what can your colleagues do for you? You know, you're leading change and you're developing all these really innovative research projects to make the academy more humane and more inclusive. And I want to know what we can all be doing for you.
I want to provide a very logistical, straightforward answer to that. Hire us as faculty in your departments. Give us grants to continue doing our research. Provide opportunities to work with students. Accept our proposals at educational conferences and provide resources and opportunities for us to continue to do this work.
This is Kat. I'll add yay to all of those things, all necessary. And I would also add that people should be using their influence and their power and their structures that benefit them to benefit us and bring us to campuses. Create events where we're the featured speaker. We're doing serious, rigorous work. And I would say, give us our respect and put us in the places that maybe you're not us, you're not walking in these shoes, you haven't done this research, but we are doing the work. And so it's an opportunity for people to bring more visibility to people doing the work and the work itself.
This is Julia. I would add in thinking specifically about or speaking specifically to disability services practitioners, where a lot of what we read day to day, week to week about disability is in disability practitioner. Like it's like our, it's like be a head listserv, might be the dishy listserv, might be disability compliance in higher education. Start with the special issue as, you know, engage with JPED overall, but then also like push yourself into disability studies research, like read one thing a month, engage with everyone's work on this panel and other, like all of the scholars who contribute to the special issue have published incredible work that engages with these themes more deeply, but also read fiction that centers disabled characters of color. I think just it's like the ongoing work to humanize, to really see disabled folks of color isn't going to necessarily come from only practitioner-focused spaces. Like you're also going to have to be bridging to other writing in other places, whether that is fiction, whether that is more kind of scholarly academic research and journals in disability studies in higher education. So I think just kind of seeking out that work of seeking out and like always trying to reflect and expand and read things that maybe feel uncomfortable or that don't kind of the language isn't the language that you're used to, or it's not those oral histories that we're so comfortable with. It's kind of pushing you. I think that that practice is such an important muscle to be building all the time.
That is so well put, Julia. Thank you. And thanks to all of you, Gabrielle, Kat, Daniel, and Julia. I appreciate the work you're doing, and this has been a great conversation. The five of us have been chatting about the intersections of race and disability in higher education, which is the basis for Volume 38, Issue 2 of the Journal of Postsecondary Education and Disability, which my guests co-edited together. That issue is available open access on the AHEAD website. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Full Speed Ahead, the quickest route from research to practice. Catch you next time.